up. It's going to get worse. We're honing in. We started with the broadfield context, then we looked at exploitation, labour exploitation. Now we're down to the hardcore sexual violence of refugee women. Linda.
Thank you. Thank you, Jenny, for your very generous introduction. And Jennifer, where have you gone? To you for yours. It was indeed a privilege to work with you that year in Geneva as well. And on that note, I think I need to say that while both you and Jenny are giving Eileen Pittaway and I a great deal of credit for some of the changes in international law that we've been part of achieving, we were very much only part of achieving those things. Dr. Eileen Pittaway, who's the director of the Centre for Refugee Research, and my colleague, many of you know, and she's been advocating and fighting for rights of refugee women to protection from rape and sexual violence for many years as part of a network of human rights activists at the global level. So the work that I've been involved in for the last 10 years has been but a small part of enormous advocacy efforts on the part of women around the globe. And some of the most significant members of that advocacy push have been and continue to be refugee women themselves. Some of you may be familiar with a Security Council resolution that passed in late 2008, Resolution 1820, which for the first time firmly puts the issue of rape in conflict on the agenda of the Security Council. Now, an earlier resolution, Resolution 1325, on women and peace building, did raise the issue of sexual violence in conflict and highlight the importance that women play in peace building and the fact that women and girls are often most impacted upon in war and conflict in terms of rape and sexual violence. But what 1820 did was say that the Security Council cannot just on occasion look at the issue of rape and sexual violence, they must actively report on the impacts of conflict and on the incidence of sexual violence. This is an issue that the Security Council must be concerned about. So that was the key difference. That's why 1820 is so important. The reason I raise it is that some of the key documentation that supported the case for that resolution to be passed was human rights documentation collected by refugee women, and particularly refugee women from Burma, who for many years have been sneaking across the border back into Burma to document the kind of abuses that are being perpetrated, particularly against the ethnic people, by the military regime, by the soldiers of the SPDC. When Condoleezza Rice, whatever one may think of her, stood before the Security Council to fight for this resolution, she quoted directly from the multiple reports that those women had collected. The human face, the suffering, the reality of what rape and sexual violence means in the lives of women, girls and families. It was critical and important work that they did. So the movement to fight for justice, global justice for refugee women and girls and protection from sexual violence, is a global movement, and I've had the privilege of being a tiny cog in a very big wheel. Okay, I think we're talking about legal issues and a legal framework. I agree, Alison set the scene magnificently. The human rights framework is a legal framework, and that's what gives it its potency and its power. But as Alison also pointed out, the human rights framework is much more than a legal framework. It's a discursive framework. It's a political framework. It's a philosophical framework. It's a framework that can galvanise our efforts and our focus to fight for justice. We use it politically to support access to rights for those who don't have rights. And so much of our advocacy as human rights activists has been about using the human rights framework politically. It's also a framework that needs to be real. As Alison said, it needs to be applied. It needs to be meaningful in people's lives. It needs to be culturally resonant. And it can be, while still being a universal, focusing, mobilising framework for justice. To be a refugee, by international legal definition, requires that you have suffered or are at risk of severe violations of your human rights. It's clear in the international definition as written within the 1951 Refugee Convention. You need to be unwilling or unable to return to your home country because you fear ongoing persecution or because you know your government won't protect you. And you need to be claiming persecution on one of five grounds: race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group, or political opinion. Already from the wording of the Refugee Convention, from the use of the male gender, from the lack of reference to gender as a ground for persecution, we start to see the origin of some of the historical challenges that we've faced in seeking protection for refugee women. While it's generally internationally accepted now, thanks to the advocacy of human rights lawyers, of thinkers like Hilary Charlesworth, Christine Chinkin, those who identified and spoke to the gender silences, the gaps in international law, that refugee lawyers, that judges will have been encouraged to interpret the social group criteria within the convention as relating to persecution on grounds of gender. Granting refugee status, for example, to a young Somali woman who was at risk because of her single status in Somalia, because it was well known that given the ongoing conflict, young single women were particularly at risk of rape and sexual abuse. It's been applied in situations where women have been fleeing female genital mutilation. It has been applied in situations of women and men seeking protection on grounds of their sexuality. But it's it continues to be an ad hoc application and an area where we need to continue to sustain our advocacy. As an international community composed of states, the majority of whom are members of the United Nations, and who have voluntarily signed on to the Charter of the United Nations, and therefore a commitment to implement the principles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, one of which is the right to seek asylum, now accepted as a principle of customary international law. And that's important. It's particularly important in our region of the world, where so few governments have signed on to the 1951 Convention. So where are the majority of refugees across the Asia Pacific? They're in Nepal. They're in Thailand. They're in Malaysia. They're in countries that have not signed on to the Refugee Convention. But at a minimum, according to the customary principles of international law, we expect countries to keep their borders open and to not return refugees to situations of danger where they fear abuse or persecution. There are additional obligations on nations such as our own who voluntarily, as Alison said, signed on to the 1951 Convention and its 1967 Protocol, requiring us to provide to refugees the same rights afforded to other aliens, is the language, so to other residents, to other non-citizens who we have recognised have a legitimate right to be here. That is to provide refugees with protection from further abuses and to assist them to rebuild their lives, to realise their full range of human rights. And yet, how do you even begin to rebuild a life after your family and community have been torn apart by war? After you fled across a border to a refugee camp in the hope of asylum and safety, to find yourself confined and at ongoing risk of further violence and denial of your rights, or to an urban slum in a major city, forced to live in overcrowded and unsanitary conditions, to work in dangerous jobs for which you are paid far less than the local population, and where you face daily risks of arrest and deportation because you are regarded not as a refugee, but as an economic or illegal migrant. Or perhaps you have even managed to arrive, either officially or unofficially, in a country like Australia, full of hope for a new life, to find yourself detained in an isolated detention centre, or resettled into a community in which you feel unwanted and unwelcome. Rather than achieving safety, you face new risks, new human rights abuses, new dangers, and together these compound the abuses and traumas you've already suffered. These are the risks and realities that face some 12.9 million people recognised as refugees. Similar risks face undocumented migrant workers, the some 30 million internally displaced people who live in refugee-like situations but within the borders of their own country. My work has focused more specifically on refugee communities, but I acknowledge the deep parallels and, in fact, the frequent intersections between trafficking of refugee women and trafficked women who become refugees as well, and Jennifer and I have talked about this in the past. However, the refugee experience is also a gendered experience. While many risks and abuses are shared by women and men, girls and boys, there are particular risks and human rights abuses which overwhelmingly are experienced by women. These are epidemic levels of rape and sexual abuse, which tragically characterise the lives of refugee women and girls across the globe. Drawing on 9 years of research with refugee communities in camps and urban areas in countries across Asia and Africa, I want to briefly explore this afternoon the extent and impacts of this violence and talk about some of the advocacy with which I've been involved to prevent and address this violence. This advocacy has taken me to both meetings of the Commission for the Status of Women, who are the body responsible for monitoring the implementation of international policy commitments that were made to women through the Beijing Women's Human Rights Process. So the series of world conferences on women that were held starting back in 1975 in the International Year of Women, conference in Mexico, which for the first time put the particular needs of women on the international stage. There were conferences in Copenhagen, conferences in Nairobi, perhaps the most well-known conference in 1995, which I didn't attend, was held in Beijing. And the outcome of that conference was a policy document called the Beijing Platform for Action, a powerful blueprint that set out a roadmap for the kind of strategies that governments and NGOs and corporations needed to implement to address failings with respect to women enjoying the full gamut of their human rights. It focused on 12 critical areas ranging from girl children to education, but it had a particular focus on women in armed conflict and women in violence, and made huge contributions to raising in the international policy arena the magnitude of the problem of domestic violence, moving domestic violence out of the closets of hidden and private violence onto the international stage as an issue of international concern, as a crime like other crimes. Supporting the efforts of women to have recognised the extent to which rape was used and is used as a strategy of war, is used to destroy women, families and communities. Powerful advocacy in support of the writing of the statute of the International Criminal Court, a statute which recognises the particularly gendered nature of war and conflict. So all of that advocacy was important. I was privileged enough to attend meetings in 2000 that were part of the preparatory committee for the passing of the International Criminal Court and advocacy to review commitments made by governments at Beijing. As Jennifer mentioned, since that time I've been actively involved each year in attending meetings of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. So both the formal government policy meetings as well as the NGO consultations. And by regularly attending those meetings and understanding those policy making processes, have been with colleagues successful in getting the issue of the particular risks that women and girls face not only firmly onto the policy agenda, but into new soft international law through the passing of what's called an executive committee conclusion, so a conclusion on the protection of women and girls at risk, okay, which was aimed to improve policy and service provision to improve protection for refugee women and girls in refugee camps, in urban cities, and on resettlement to countries like Australia. One of the things I want to do now is to show you a very brief DVD in which a small number of refugee women share their experiences and talk about the individual and community impacts of rape. It's called Refugee Women Do Talk About Rape. The reason that my colleague Dr. Eileen Pittaway and I made this film was we were tired of being told by many service providers and UN staff that one of the reasons why refugee women were not protected was because of the shame associated with rape, the stigma against speaking out, the cultural sanctions against doing so. I'm not disputing the existence and terrible impacts of shame and of stigma. But what I'm challenging, what we're challenging, is its use as an excuse to not take action. Its use as an excuse not to listen, not to find safe and sensitive ways through which to discover the truth about the extent of rape in refugee and conflict situations, and to take action. We had and have notebooks full of refugee women's individual accounts of testimonies about rape and sexual abuse, shared in individual interviews, informal interviews, and community consultations with women in Kenya, Ethiopia, Sri Lanka after the tsunami, New Delhi in India, and Thailand. And I assure you that we never once framed the question as, please tell me about your experience of rape. Instead, we created spaces in which women were free to share and discuss the range of human rights abuses they might have faced, and most importantly, to share their ideas for solutions. This film is only a tiny snapshot of what, with permission, was shared and filmed in some of these consultations.
killed, and half of the women has been raped. What happened in East Timor is the method of the rape is the same with the method in Aceh.
And we went for all the young girls. And there were five guys who took me to the house, which I'm not ashamed to talk about. Because I've gone through it. And I know it was not my wish to go through it, but because of God. It hit me in my right ear. I can't hear at all. That's why I shout when I talk. Because I'm deaf in this ear. And then five of them went with me. They raped me. Terrible, terrible thing. How many times? You can talk about being raped because it's just common thing. Even in the refugee camp, if you want to escape, you have to sleep with the soldier or the refugee. If you not sleep with them, you're going to die. So what's your choice? And even you will see your thing. You will see people that killed you, that raped you, that treated you. You will come and see them. But what proof do you have to drive them? I mean, no proof.
Sorry that that's sticking, but I think the message is clear.
Is it just the one in the middle? Can you press that one? Yeah.
No.
I think we've got the message.
Yeah, I think you do. Actually, get back to my slides. Fora in which these accounts were shared were courts of testimony of refugee women, where women chose to stand up and flag these issues in public and political spaces. As I said earlier, over the last 9 years, I've had the opportunity to work in multiple refugee sites across Africa and in Asia. And by returning on many occasions to Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya, to the Thai-Burma border, having the opportunity to visit refugee camps and work with women in Ethiopia, in Sri Lanka in the IDP areas after the tsunami, more recently in New Delhi in the urban areas, has given me an opportunity to build a deeper understanding of the multiple impacts and causes of rape and sexual violence. Journeys of rape. Women, as we know, are raped in conflict situations, often not once, often on multiple occasions. A colleague of mine from Sierra Leone shares accounts of women who were raped on the first occasion by government soldiers, and she gave birth to a baby of rape. On a second occasion, she was raped again by rebel soldiers and also gave birth to a child from that rape. On a third occasion, she was raped by UN peacekeepers and gave birth to a child from that rape. The numbers of babies born of rape in conflict situations is something we rarely talk about, and yet it impacts extensively on women's lives. We hear whispers in communities in Australia about some of the challenges that women from conflict situations face in parenting. Often those challenges translate to the removal of children by child protection agencies. But have we really investigated what's happening? Women are raped at borders by police and by border guards, and in refugee camps and in countries of first asylum. Not just by one kind of perpetrator, but by multiple perpetrators. Women face multiple sites of risk. One of the young women who I met on a visit to Kakuma camp in the north of Kenya in 2003, said to me in utter frustration one day when she was being told by some of the NGOs in the camp that one of the reasons she was at risk was because she was wearing Western dress, This is a rape camp. It doesn't matter what you wear. If you wear shorts, they will rape you. If you wear Muslim dress, they will rape you. This is a rape camp. The UNHCR head of that camp, on an earlier visit, when my colleague and I had asked him why there seemed to be so much difficulty in identifying women at extreme risk, because at that time, Australia was struggling to fill the Women at Risk program, which is part of our refugee resettlement program. We couldn't find enough women at risk. We asked the head of the camp about women at risk. He swept his hand out the window to the sort of tent camp and the desperation outside and said, but the women are all at risk in this camp. Do you want to resettle all of them? He said to my colleague the next day, rather flippantly, actually, I'll give you a prize if you can find a woman in this camp who hasn't been raped. The ubiquity of rape and sexual violence in refugee camps, I'm not exaggerating. What are the impacts? What are the things that put women most at risk? Women and girls who are known to have been raped being ostracised by family and community. Not all, but some. What are the risks if you're put out of the compound in which you live? How do you survive in a camp if you've been rejected by your community? How do you feed yourself? How do you feed your child if you have a child? Survival sex? Exchanging sex for food. About the only way. Putting up with being raped on a daily basis in order to feed yourself. As one of the women from the South African government said at a meeting in 2003 in Geneva, often the choice for women is between agreeing to a marriage to face the prospect at least of being raped by the same man every night rather than multiple perpetrators. Unaccompanied minors without family support who are often taken and informally fostered are often at high risk. Girls forced to marry. Abuse of children by stepfathers because of the sort of relationships that women are often forced to form. Abuse by religious leaders and other men in positions of authority. So multiple sites of risk. Similar but different risks are faced by women in urban areas. This is a quote from refugee women, Chin women, in New Delhi in India. The women have to go to the market at night to get spoiled vegetables to feed themselves, and they're sexually harassed at the market. They ask the stallholders for spoiled vegetables. The stallholders just laugh at them and throw the vegetables to the animals and crows. So people are fighting with animals for refugees. To be a refugee woman, to be a refugee man, is to be frequently humiliated and disrespected. Women in urban areas face particular risks, risks of sexual abuse and harassment by employers in factories, as domestic workers, forced to live in overcrowded situations, 20 young women and young men in a room. High incidences of domestic violence because multiple families are forced to live in the same room. Unwanted pregnancies, unsafe abortion, rape and sexual abuse by men in the local community while collecting food or water. Current statistics from Iraq, from Syria and Jordan indicate that the vast majority of women now are forced to work in brothels. To survive, engaging in survival sex, are Iraqi refugee women. So these are patterns of abuse that we see across the globe. They are not linked to ethnicity or to culture. They are linked to conflict and the refugee experience. I'm out of time, but there are multiple factors that compound these risks that we need to take into account in thinking about our responses. Lack of livelihood increases risks for women of being forced to engage in survival sex. The loss of citizenship and the denial of any rights associated with citizenship leave refugee women and girls and families vulnerable. The loss of identity and assuming the identity of refugee women, the perception of vulnerability, of being unwanted and discriminated against. A loss of autonomy when your right to make decisions about your lives is taken away in a refugee camp or a detention centre. The frequent distortion of culture and cultural practices, and the often far too easy way that we put domestic violence and difficulties that refugee communities face down to it's their culture and it's a cultural practice, rather than unpacking and understanding the complex intersections of conflict, patriarchy, militarism, and cultural practice. Notions of justice or lack of access to justice, refugee camps running almost as kind of no man's lands with customary and camp justice systems that have developed to fill a vacuum when the host country and the international community haven't cared enough to provide refugee communities with access to justice. And at a global and a local level, the impacts of xenophobia and racism, which all too often compound the risks that women face by keeping them silent, for fear that talking about domestic violence, for fear that talking about internal abuse within their own communities will only further stigmatise them as refugees from a country who are unwanted and unwelcome. Thank you. Thank you.